And it is time for us to begin this evening. If you want to open up your Bibles to your Old Testament, particularly 1st and 2nd Chronicles, that's going to be our focus for the next few weeks. I think for the adult class, it'll be the next 15 weeks or so, give or take. On Wednesday nights, we'll be spending our time in the text of 1st and then 2nd Chronicles. All right, before we go any further, now that you've got that part of your Old Testament opened back up and you've creased the seam of an uncommon book, not a lot of time that gets spent in these two texts for a couple of reasons, and we'll talk about that tonight. We're going to begin our class with prayer, so if you would bow with me in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time. We thank you for the study we share and the opportunity tonight to grow and be enriched by the testimony of your servants and the message that they have brought to us. Help us to be good Bible students, to be good listeners, to be willing to become more like your Son and to grow through the increased knowledge and time spent in your word. Please forgive us of our sins. And this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so opening question. It's similar to one that was asked a couple Thursday nights ago. How long has it been since you were in an adult or any other Bible study that was specifically about 1st and 2nd Chronicles?
Does that count when you had classes starting at the beginning of the Bible going all the way through?
That's cheating. That big survey is cheating.
That's
it. Zero, for you, you've never been in a 1st and 2nd Chronicles class exclusively about it? That's fine. I did a little digging. I went through my stuff. I've taught through 1st and 2nd Chronicles before, but I haven't done it here, other than the survey is cheating. We did a survey in our second Bible study for a while, and we got through 1st and 2nd Chronicles. But that was an overview. That was a look at it really quick in a short amount of time. And so it's not an in-depth look at the text. It's interesting that that's the case, because if you start doing some research and digging around and saying, are there material written for adult Bible classes, specifically with 1st and 2nd Chronicles in mind, the answer to that is not very much. That's a really small amount of stuff that's written that way. It's interesting when you start reading and kind of digging around and looking at the history of local churches that I've been part of and maybe you've been part of, it really doesn't happen very much. And so on the very top level, it's probably a book that at the same time feels very unfamiliar. But then when you look at the content, you go, well, I should know this. This is all stuff that should be familiar to me on different edges. And I think that's both good and bad. I think there's probably some aspects of that part of it that are super valuable, and some of it that's maybe we can make some better choices about. Here's another thing. A lot of times when we start looking at what to teach, study, or preach from, we take our audience into consideration. And so specifically, for those who have taught Bible classes for individuals under the age of 10, raise your hand if that's you, if you've done that. Classes just for people under the age of 10. By the way, that means you're going to be teaching soon, so you volunteered to do that. I'm not kidding, but not kidding. Here's something to think about. When you're doing those classes, do you try to make some of the more heart-wrenching parts of it and bloody and gory sections of the Old Testament softer? Of course you do. Like we don't need to necessarily whitewash the Bible, but we need to make sure we're aware of our audience, aware of the hearers, aware of what's going on for all of those things. And so we do variations of what I sometimes call verbal modesty, and where we might use a euphemism. It's a modern euphemism. That's something that is a softer word for a harder, more harsh word. Euphemisms aren't always coarse. They're just softening of the edges. The Bible does that, by the way, quite a bit. The soft edge for death is what? sleep, right? We already know that euphemisms are actually employed in metaphor and in various poetic forms to take some of the little edges off for all kinds of reasons, not just to make them softer for a smaller audience. Now, that's important because think for a moment if I ask the second question, have you taught 1 and 2 Samuel before or been in a Bible class with 1 and 2 Samuel before? And I add the last one, to kids under the age of 10 as a third answer. So have you been in that class before? The answer is yes, you have. You've been in that class here. Like, we just finished that, right? Have you taught that class before? Well, I just did it here. You may have as well. Have you taught it to younger children? Probably. A lot of those stories become the heart of kids' material. But think for a moment. 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles. 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel. 1 Kings, 2 Kings. Which one is rougher? Which one has more gore? Which one makes David look worse? This is an obvious answer if I'm asking the question. What do you think the answer to the question is? 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings make everything a lot more rough than what you see in 1 and 2 Chronicles. Now, that's important because we have to ask this question. Why? Why is that the case? Is someone melting down the Bible story, particularly about David, to make him look differently? Is there something else going on? Is there other purposes involved? How does this fit into the big picture? Because a lot of times in the Old Testament, we're given one account of an event. Not exclusively, but a lot. In the New Testament, we get the Gospels, right? The Gospels give us four accounts, right? And sometimes we actually get a fifth version of the Gospels. When the people in the epistles and in the book of Acts talk backward about Jesus, that's sometimes referred to as actually our fifth gospel, which is the rest of the letters, because they tell us things that may not necessarily be specifically mentioned in the gospels themselves. Paul does that when he talks about things about Jesus and the Lord's Supper, where he expands our understanding. James does that a lot in the book of James compared to the Sermon on the Mount. So those Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount, James's text there is like an expanded version. And so he expands on it in a few ways. And so James is very much rooted in the Sermon on the Mount. So we're kind of comfortable with that there. Well, 1 and 2 Chronicles does that. But it does it like at hyperspeed, because it'll cover a lot of stuff in a shorter amount of chapters. And there's generally reasons why you might do that. And so let's think about that a little bit as we begin to talk about this very uncommon book from our studies of it. Especially because the first 9 chapters that we'll look at next Bible class, we're not even going to read those tonight, are all what? Did you guys read ahead and look at 1 and 2 Chronicles? It was in the email that was sent out. So what do you think is in the first 9 chapters of 1 Chronicles? Genealogies. Who loves genealogies? Now, who loves Bible genealogies, not your own families? Nobody does, but everyone does. Here's why. We love the genealogies when we're looking for small details and we're like archaeologists trying to scrape off the dust of something and see what it is, or we're trying to create a better understanding of who came where, what, when, and why, and all that stuff. But we don't like the genealogies if we have to read them out loud. And we don't like the genealogies if there's no other reason for them. But they're just like a long list of names. That's just people that I don't understand why we're remembering them. And so that's important for us to think and kind of walk through. So let me add this. If you're going to read a book, watch a movie, listen to somebody's story, would you prefer that they begin like 1 Chronicles does with a long genealogy? Okay, so that if that happens to you on that Sunday afternoon nap space and the movie or the television show or the book you're reading starts that way, how fast do you fall asleep? Like I'm done. Especially if you're like past 33 degrees. You lean back just far enough. are there, now here's the balance to that, are there genealogies in the Gospels? Are those a little bit more concise and like you kind of read through them in a different way? But they also begin with a little bit of backstory. There's two backstories that real quick. Backstory number one, what you already know. Backstory number two, how they introduce them. Even the Gospel of John actually begins with the genealogy. So wait a minute, no, it doesn't. Yeah, it does. Because where do we learn about the origin of Jesus in that genealogy? Is it earthly or heavenly? It's the heavenly genealogy of Jesus. Because it goes from, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then it bumps to, and the Word became flesh and dwelt amongst men. And so it too is a genealogy. It's just more fun on a literary scale because, man, it's like rocket speed. Not even hyperspeed, man. It just hops from planet to planet, and boom, it's there. Because it's heavenly in that regard. All right, so that gives us at least some context to think about First and Second Chronicles in a different way. That there's a reason for it. It's absolutely different than First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings. Even though it's digging through the same dirt. It's digging through the same historical soil. It's crawling through the same experiences. It's trying to do something different there, and you're going to see that highlighted in different ways. Like, let's say, Numbers. What's the alternate title that we mentioned when we studied through Numbers a while back? Do you guys remember its second name? It's far more cool than Numbers. It's actually the Tanakh or the Hebrew Bible's version of expressing it this. It's the, starts with the W, the wilderness. The wilderness, right? Is that more fun? That changes the book, right? Because you change the title of the book has to be different. So thinking about that again a little bit, we say that this is First and Second Chronicles. The alternate way to think about this is not First and Second Chronicles, super boring title. An alternate title for the text is the Chronicler. That's the in the Hebrew text. It's all clumped together as one book. It's not First and Second. And it's like this title of some guy doing a thing. You can think about it if you want modern movies. I think maybe The Transporter. That sound like a fun movie all of a sudden? Alan, what's a Western title that's similar to that? I know you got like 16 Westerns. You got to have something in there.
El Dorado.
El Dorado is a fun title. This is a place. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Like super concise. They tell you something. So this is the Chronicler. Now it shifted it to some guy doing something. Some person doing something. Now the emphasis shifts with the title, right? Like it does. If you think about how a title influences how we think about a story, because now we're expecting different things. If I were to ask Gary about, what's the Air Force One? He loves that movie. You know, I can automatically, he's like, I know what you're talking about, I know that movie. And it's not really about the point. But it all takes place on the plane. So that shifts a little bit too. So now you've got, it's different than what I've already studied, remembered, and recognized. Its title is actually a little different because we're going to look at them together, right in sequence. We're not going to plod through them and break them up. And we've already pre-staged our mind to acknowledge that though they're different, and its title maybe is a little bit more focused in a different direction, it's the same story. But it begins maybe at a different point for us. And so just to kind of think about what we're going to do, this is the sequence of these upcoming classes. And so you're wondering, hey, what's what we're going to be, what we're going to do? It's roughly this. This is the approximation of how things are going to go. And you'll notice the scope's kind of big, right? First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings, we think about those books and we think about which three big chunks. So who was our first powerful king in Israel?
Saul,
right? Our dumpster fire of a king. Like he looks like a king. He literally acts like a king. He does exactly what they said kings would do. Tax you, have your kids go out to war. Like, that's literally what he does. And then he behaves like the kings around him. We replace Saul with whom? Who's our next king?
David,
right? And David, does David look like a king according to the biblical text? And in 1 and 2 Samuel...
Physically, no.
Physically, he doesn't. What would you say if you were to quickly sum up how transparent or open is that text with David's life? Are his weakness shown to us? Is his folly shown to us? Even his repentance is shown to us. And so in that particular case, pretty open. And then we go to Solomon. And Solomon's always confusing what we're going to do with him, because on the one hand, he is connected to the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. His beginning is awesome. We assume that Ecclesiastes, he's the Koheleth. That's the preacher in Ecclesiastes. And we say, well, that means he turned around at the end. And yet, do we actually have any evidence in the historical accounts of him turning around at the end? Do we want him to? No, absolutely. But there's actually no evidence on that side that says he put away all his foreign wives, broke all those contracts and all those things. And actually, the evidence seems to suggest those foreign wives became part of the inheritance of the future kingly lines that fought and just exploded into awfulness. Which is that last chunk of history, which is the semi-united, not united at all, super divided, crumbling Israel. So they're all in there too. Well, in 1 and 2 Chronicles, some of that appears. But not all of it. Because there's different things that get emphasized in different ways. So let me hint, here's something important with it. 1 Chronicles isn't about David or the entire kingly line as a physical king and a physical kingdom. It's actually trying to pull the strings up a little higher so that we can see things a little differently. And 1 and 2 Chronicles is more about the theology that God is trying to explain to man through the kings. And this is what I mean by that. We sometimes will ask this question, hey, when you look at the kings of Israel, you can recognize that though some of them are very good men, and they are at different times, and they do very good things, they're always insufficient, right? And we can say the question, well, what's missing? Well, God is almost always missing in that. In the Chronicles, the work of the chronicler, he's indicating that to a higher level of appearance. So we're going to see that more clearly, that, hey, this is actually trying to teach us a little bit differently the big picture principles that were not necessarily hidden in the more detailed historical account, but weren't the primary purpose of that more detailed historical account. Another way to have this story begin here in the text is to think about it like I've said before in a couple of places, and think about it as if you are going to sit with your grandpa or grandma, it'd work fine either way, on the banks of the river, and you're going to hear about from your grandparents, hey, how did we get to where we're at? How did we get here? And here is someplace after all these events. Here could be, because of what we're reading here, in captivity, or after captivity. So you could be in one of those two places physically and hear this whole story as given to us by the chronicler that we would call 1 and 2 Chronicles. And it begins, how? We're not going to read it in detail, but how does 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 1 begin?
Adam.
Adam. the great two-purpose name, right? So Adam is how we pronounce his name in English, right? But it also has a meaning of mankind, as the other end, Adam, if we're going to use the Hebrew root for his name, mankind. And it begins with mankind, which is different than how 1 and 2 Samuel begin, right? Because if we were thinking, well, this is the same thing, these are just kind of like a repeat. So it's not that part two. In fact, it's on the river, and you got the little kid, you, talking to your grandpa and say, how do we get here? And so he begins his story, like grandpas do, at whatever beginning he's chosen. And so it doesn't begin, so there it was. It begins at the beginning. Whereas Genesis 1:1 begins with in the beginning. It has a more formal introduction, a formalized beginning point. From that point forward, the text goes, using one of the skipping methodologies of genealogies, where they focus in on key generational participants, to move us from Adam to each of the steps that would bring us to very important people like Abraham, Abram, Avraham, Abraham, moving forward to even some of the lesser important ones that are integral to the story that then bring us to David. And so it kind of moves us to David because David is super important. And again, if you're using our imprint idea of this is not a detailed history, but a theological history, a teaching history, then now it makes more sense that not every single good thing a king or a person did, and not every single awful or evil thing a person did, makes the cut of the editing room floor to tell this bigger story. So that's part of what's going on. Now, to you and I, when we get to some of these long names, like if I were to talk about verse 5 really quick, the sons of Japheth, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. Raise your hand if you know who any of those are. Does that resonate with you at all? Like the names seem kind of, especially if you give them a little Hebrew guttural sound, all of a sudden they sound cooler. And roughly that's the trick, by the way, for Hebrew, is like have a little bit of a cough phlegm thing going on. And that really just, that's how you work it out. Like that's, everything sounds that way. It's like if you just kind of choke a little on the hard sounds and realize there's no ch sound for most of it, boom, you're in. So that doesn't do it for us. But we, culturally, historically, if I were to start talking about Babe Ruth, does that evoke emotions for you? If I start talking about Willie Mays, for baseball folks, we're in baseball time frame right now, so does that invoke feelings for folks? See if I can pick into my Braves. Tom Glavine, is that Braves? That sounds Braves. At least at one point he was with the Braves. Raleigh Fingers, I got other West Coast guys and stuff that I can remember for baseball. They make a sense for us. They kind of connect a name for us. And so when we start talking about them, we immediately picture what we think that's like. And we create a visual space for it. So something to think about when we go through 1st and 2nd Chronicles is to realize that this genealogy that starts it off in this beginning 9 chapters are really designed to create on the ground of the story a picture that is both historic but actually personal. Because those baseball players, raise your hand if you've ever met any major league player for more than like 2 minutes. Just look at you trying to show off. You know, a few of us actually have. There's actually, Jesse's actually met one, doesn't even realize it, Kerry Keenan. You know, he's a preacher down in Florida and played for a number of teams. Some of us have met other NFL individuals, have gone from the Major League Baseball to NFL or other sports personalities. But in reality, even though we may have met them and have connected with them a little bit, It's not the same if we start talking about Les's grandpa. And he starts trying to tell stories about that. Is that a different feeling? For all of us, yeah, because it's Les's grandfather. And if some of us could remember or have a story that's five generations back, I want to hear that, because that could be super cool. Well, this Bible story here, which is history, but still a story or a narrative, is connected to the audience that's hearing it when they're painting that picture. This is your people. And let me add one step to that for tonight. This is your people. The chronicler's work is your people. Because what does the New Testament teach us regarding the Gentiles who are grafted into the kingdom? Are we any less than the Israelites who were born into Israel and then were learning of God and eventually all became part of the kingdom by choice? We're the same or that? We're all sons of Israel in that sense. We're all possessing the faith of Abraham when we do that. So guess what? All these guys' names who seem super unfamiliar, they're all your family. In a real sense, not just on page of paper, that says, oh, someone said this is my family member. They're literally your family in every valuable way. So keeping that in mind, with this one literary work, again, it's at least exile time, exilic, if we're going to use the technical tense. Could be post-exilic, which I kind of think is probably after the exile, after they got back. There's good reasons for either view, though. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything. But now you have a picture of people who didn't really know their story because they hadn't lived it, who are either out of their homeland or recently returned, who need to know, hey, I need to know this. Because I say I'm of Israel. When people come to America and they're going to be naturalized as U.S. citizens for all kinds of various reasons, either marriage, either they've got immigrant visas and they've moved up into status and they're going to take that test. You ever seen the test for citizenship in the U.S.?
Probably none of us could pass it. I could.
You got to get ready for it. A buddy of mine who grew up in Canada had to take it a few years back. And, you know, he's a smart guy. He had to study for weeks in advance of it. And they had months of classes before that. So he had to do months of classes. You know, he's a grown man who is now officially a dual citizen. He still retains his citizenship of Canada, but he's a full citizen of the United States. And he had to take a serious test. Now, I think the high school kids probably could pass the test because it's part of the stuff you study in school. All us old people, we've forgotten all that. Like, it's all gone. So since we know that's the case, that's kind of what's going on here. This is a reminder of the structure of your citizenship in the kingdom of Israel, but it's our heritage too in Christ. So that's part of that. Like, that gives us some structure to it. Any questions so far? We've got 15 minutes of introductory stuff that I plan to kind of work with. I got a few more things to do on the introduction side. I want to stop here and make sure everyone has a chance. If you've got questions so far, thoughts, things they're curious about. Rich?
I like your analogy of the grandfather kind of sitting down and telling the story. So based on the audience that this is written, and you mentioned exile, so is it likely that you've got folks that were born in exile, trying to understand what's going on?
Oh, yeah.
We're heading back. And or we've got people who maybe have been, I don't know, integrated into the society that they got taken off to. And now they're kind of going, hey, remember we go back here. So helping them kind of understand what the beginning of the heritage is, again, we'll get them back there.
Yeah, and it's absolutely part of that. Like, it's a lot of kind of resetting the mental and emotional connection to their heritage. Here's something that's another way to think about this book. And for a while, actually for this class, I'm going to try to keep referring to it as this book. That means 1st and 2nd Chronicles when I say this book. It pulls as its content sometimes literal same text appears from the Torah, the Tanakh, which is the first five books of our Old Testament, Joshua to Kings, some of that. It will pull from Isaiah, Jeremiah, the Psalms, the Proverbs, and a few bits come from some of the lesser space-taking books of the Old Testament. So it almost pulls from everything, if not everything. It gets pulled in there. I say almost because there's a couple of books that don't have any direct citations or direct references that aren't in that list. So this book can be thought of as a Reader's Digest version of the Old Testament. It can be thought of as a sermon where someone is basically preaching, this is who you are, Israel. And when it does that, especially when it like almost copies text like a quotation, although they don't really do quotations like that in the text, it gives an interpretation to it. It gives meaning to it at times. It gives reason for it. And this happened because, or for. That's different than some of the historic books you've already read, especially if because we just finished 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, where there's not as much big picture reasoning. It's small picture. It's this king is bad, this enemy of Israel is bad, judgment is coming, justice is coming, or you're bad, Israel, you're being sanctioned and sent off into captivity, and your bad kingdom, you're being sanctioned and sent off into captivity, which happens on the micro scale in those historical books. One more thing, and I think this is probably for me the biggest catch to it, is that the way the stories of the kings are reused here almost always takes the best parts of them. So another thing to think about with 1 and 2 Chronicles, the chronicler or this book, it's highly messianic. It's a Messiah book. And the Messiah is, for us, as we understand it, whom?
Christ,
right? To the Israelite, though, if you're thinking about the Israelite, who didn't have our expanded post-Jesus knowledge, Messiah is for them whom?
A king, for them, physical king.
Yeah.
Israel power.
Yeah. Anything else around that space? I don't want to run over anyone's comments and stuff. Standard rule applies. You can raise your hand. You got to wave out and say, hey, Phil, you're wrong. That's perfectly fine, too. Any of those are appropriate answers to some of this. So now you've got a book that is Reader's Digest, maybe a sermon now. We thought about its application and how it reshapes our understanding of these stories. Reader's Digest, reshaping, theological because it's messianic. It's using the best parts of the lives of the kings to tell a story that says your king should look like this. And it raises the bar of what a king should look like up really high. Because think about it this way. Think about all the good things in our list of kings. Not just the kings we call good, but all the things the kings did that were good. Would it be easy for one man to be all of that consistently and regularly? Based on how all the kings behaved as our example. And we don't have anyone that really is consistently good as a king. We have ones that are better and are recognized as doing their best, but no man is really good in that sense. But they're looking for one that has that attribute. And so, to a degree, we can think about it now as something that should be teaching our young grandchild by the river to one day look for a Messiah. Because by the way, was Israel looking for a Messiah as a group? Yeah, they really were. They weren't very good at it. Were even the Pharisees, the Sadducees, looking for a Messiah? That's a shake and nod moment. Not for this choice, yeah. They wanted a puppet. But they still wanted a Messiah. They wanted a Messiah who was like them rather than like God. Another thing is to think about it, last bit for this part of the discussion, This literary portrait of a king should leave you with an impression that what they're looking for is simply somebody greater than David. And David is the standard. That's the Davidic king model of what makes a great king. David is a great king. For Israel, that's who they would say is a great king. And the chronicler is coming up and saying, you know what? Uh-uh. In fact, we need a greater king than David. We need someone who can be more than that. Gary?
Based on the way you're talking about this, we don't know who wrote it.
There's a lot of theories, but the answer to that is correct. We don't have a written attribution of whom we can definitively say they wrote this. And a lot of the Old Testament is that way too. Even the books that we attribute to Solomon, you'll notice that the way that they're ledgered, it's very careful, that it's not explicit. Like in Ecclesiastes, it never says Solomon. It's actually in the title space, which is added later to the text, that says Solomon. Even the Song of Solomon can be read the song that is of Solomon rather than his song. So a lot of these Old Testament books, we're trusting the canon. We're trusting the believers to say this is an inspired text rather than Moses wrote it like some of the early books. So they're obviously and specifically Moses's. The source for us to get that of the original manuscripts. All right, so we've identified some realities of text that include content, source material. We've recognized that it's not really pinned down to a specific author, although we can catch the time frame because he pulls from stuff that's all post-exile. He's pulling that experience across the table. Something else that's neat is that not only does it pull from that and give us kind of smaller accounts of the life of, say, David, there's things that get in there that aren't in the historical text of 1 and 2 Samuel. Like there's new stuff. And there are sections of it that are far more prophetic about the Messiah and about Israel than the rest of them. Have you ever heard anyone refer to Isaiah as the little Bible? Yes, you have. You just did. All right. So the answer to that is yes. Because it has how many books? How many chapters are in Isaiah?
66.
How many chapters or how many books are in the entire Bible?
66.
66, right? And so our canon, our Protestant Bibles has 66 books. Isaiah has 66. About the time that you complete your number of books in the Old Testament and shift into our New Testament Isaiah, is about the time that Isaiah gets more messianic and prophetic. Well, here in this is again now a shift that includes prophecy again. But not prophecy coming in the sense of an individual prophet forthtelling or foretelling. That's speaking for God or speaking about the future. That in the story, the way it's shaped, it speaks about the future. And so it doesn't come to us in the ways of Isaiah. How did Isaiah get his prophetic knowledge according to what we can read or even Ezekiel? How do we picture their insight? How does that kind of relate to us? God showed him pictures, right? God showed him things. God told him things. In the chronicler's work, in this book, it's not exactly that way. We don't have that couching narrative around it that says, the chronicler was called by God from the middle of the night to get up and he had a vision for him. It begins again with Adam, and so it's a little different there. This is also a section of the text that will synthesize, that is, squish together for our purposes here, some of the things that we think about when we think about Jesus. Jesus is not only the next David, right? Are there other Old Testament people or actions that Jesus replicates by his behavior or gets called as being connected to? What was that?
Jonah.
Well, yeah, he's outgrowth of John, because John is the last prophet of the Old Testament, and John calls him out. Is Jesus anything like Moses? They do any of the same kind of stuff? They do a lot of the same stuff, right? The whole Exodus is Matthew. Matthew is Exodus, and Exodus is Matthew. You have all the same story structures. They go up on mountains to talk about stuff and to talk to God and to talk about God. They come back down to the people and bring a message to the people. That's all like the Sermon on the Mount, dropping through that. There's baptism. Moses is connected to baptism. There's structures of temple pictures that come in. There's a whole lot of that. Well, in Chronicles, because of the way it's laid out, because it goes beyond just an individual history, that happens too, where our Messiah starts picking up the attributes of all the great leaders of Israel's past. And so you see a little Joshua there, you see a little Elijah, Elias, etc., etc., etc. And it's not the whole story. Even though it goes through what we call the entire Old Testament, it's certainly not the entire story of God's people, because A, it omits some things just because its purposes are different, and B, it leaves it with a hopeful next step as the way we think about it. For your reading going for next week, here's something to think about as a way to think about how our 9 chapters are laid out. Remember I said genealogies can be boring if we don't know why we're digging for them? Well, they can be boring anyway, but if we just don't have any reason for them, this is kind of what's going on in this genealogy here, where it's kind of taking big picture, the peoples of the world, starting from the very beginning of things, angling itself to the priesthood in Levi as a center point. Kind of important when you're thinking about a post-exile people that have no connection to their history or to their God. And so Levi becomes the center point of our little chiasm here that lays it all out for us. And then the northern tribes, and then Benjamin, and then the inhabitants of Jerusalem during the last part of the exile space and the Persia space that is the closeout of how do we get here? What's going on? And so our genealogy sets the stage. And so when you read chapters 1 through 9 between now and next Wednesday, kind of think about that as a way to, oh, there's a reason for this, and these are these people there. Which leads us to our last 2 minutes, and we pick our questions. We don't have to go down the list, but if there's something you liked or didn't like, this is where you get to ask that question, or something you want to know more about. So for our introduction, was anything new for you? Have you guys thought about 1st and 2nd Chronicles, or the Chronicler, if you want to try to work that one out, much in the past? Did you learn anything new about the book? You could say, no, I already knew all that stuff. That's perfectly fine.
I have a question.
Answers can be given.
Why? I know the important people in the Bible we should know. Why do we have to know all the people and all the kids and all that? It's hard.
Because I don't remember all of them either until I put them on a piece of paper, because I forget everything. Like, if it's not written down, it didn't happen. The reason they appear in the stories is to connect the people to the realness of the history. That these are their family members. This is your last name. This is your family name. It's your lineage. It would be the equivalent of going to the place where your relatives first stepped foot into the Americas. And saying, all right, I stepped right here, and they stepped right here. But we're not doing that literally. We're doing that in a literary sense. We're reading about it rather than physically being there. And so these genealogies are how their familiar connection was. We do that too. If we say, if I started a speech that began with 47 years ago. I know that's probably not exactly right, but you know who I'm talking about? Yeah, I'm quoting one of our presidents at a particular moment in Gettysburg. I'm quoting a version of a speech that probably was presented at Gettysburg on that day. So now we know that. And we might talk about his family because we want to give more sense to that. Well, this is just a bigger retelling. And so these genealogies are there to connect us to our family, especially in our world where we're not very connected to our people. We live very disconnected lives. Roy?
Question, how will that answer? Why did they give them the awful name?
All right, so there's actually two great answers to that. When we read their names in English, we're probably reading bad translations and transliterations of Greek first, and then Hebrew second. So their names, as we read them, when they spoke to one another, sound nothing like what we read them. My family gets on to me all the time about pronouncing a particular Old Testament God. I'm not even sure the way they want it pronounced anymore. But most folks will say Baal or Baal for B-A-A-L. All right? That's not how that word would have been used by them. Remember, you got to get a little phlegm in your voice. And so they're all shuddering at the sound. They're like, this is like a regular thing. So Baal or Baal is Baal. All right? So that's what they would have said. That's their language. So all these Hebrew names that look awkward to us are like through two bad translations to get to us. They're bad translations because they were translated into a language 300 years ago that's English, but we don't use all that language that way anymore. So they just kind of kept using them and we pronounce them the same way. Some of these names sound super awesome. I actually think like Abraham or Avraham sounds far more cool than Abraham. Sounds to me. Yeah, so that's it. Clock's up. More questions next week. I'm sure we'll have quite a few. Thanks, everybody.